make like Amber Heard and just hit it. Just aggressively, maybe a little too much. And then shit in its bed.
We're keeping that in this episode. That is our opening.
Not my goal, but all right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Dorkside Nexus. I am one of your hosts, Corey.
And I'm your other host, Tanner.
And we are really excited for this episode because we just finished episode 5 of Moon Knight.
We got one word to describe this, maybe two, actually. Trauma!
A lot of trauma, yeah.
PTSD and trauma, man. Oh my God, I'm wrecked. I'm wrecked, man. Absolutely wrecked.
Has been the case in the last few episodes, we are going to be diving into spoilers. We're headed way into spoiler territory, so join us, and here we go.
Well, we didn't cover episode 4.
Well, we should do that too.
Well, absolutely. I mean, episode 4 happened last week, and we didn't weren't recording last week, so that was missed. Yeah, so we got a lot going on in episode 4. I mean, they find Amit's tomb in it. We're not really going to rehash anything from the episode because by now you've seen all the episode and the memes and things like that. But I will say, my favorite part of the episode, it was Alexander the Great's tomb. I was loving this.
That was pretty cool. I was excited when Steven pulls out the statue of Amit. Like, we won!
We won! We won! We won! We won! We won! No, it was... My inner nerd was going insane because I love ancient Egypt, and as many people know, or you may not know, Alexander the Great's tomb has been lost to time, and no one knows where it is, so... When he walks in, when he goes, oh, it's one of the big ones. It's one of the big ones. I instantly go, it's Alexander the Great's tomb. And then he goes, oh, Macedonia. And I'm like, yep, it's Alexander the Great. I was geeking.
See, I'm not as well versed as you at that time period, ancient Egypt. So I was, you know, I was sitting there thinking, King Tut, have they found his tomb yet?
I mean,
did they ever find him?
That's about 100. We've already discovered his tomb. It would have been probably about 100 years ago at this point that his tomb was discovered. So, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what was going to happen in there.
But that episode was cool. That was really cool. And you get the backstory of Mark being on the team that killed Layla's father. So, even more emotional damage.
Oh, yeah. When they're talking about everything that happened. It's been a hot minute since I saw that episode.
Yeah, I haven't reviewed it much either, but it was you. I think another part that I liked in that episode were the mummified priests.
It was, yeah, very spooky.
Oh,
it was a
it.
Very spooky episode, honestly.
The dude got mummified on the altar there.
Oh, yeah.
I was like sitting there going, jumping up and down because I'm morbid as shit. And I'm like, oh, this is awesome. He's getting mummified.
Meanwhile, I'm sitting there anxious for Layla, who's like just on the other side of that thing. And Steven, it felt like Indiana Jones.
It was very Indiana Jones, which by the end of the episode, you learn where that persona of Steven came from.
What was it? Tomb Buster?
Tomb Buster was Dr. Steven Grant.
Which I like that they referenced that because even at the beginning of the episode with Layla doing her, you know, going around and doing her mission, that felt very Tomb Raider-esque. Oh, yeah. So mm-hmm. It was nice to see that kind of pulled all the way around full circle.
It was completely full circle. It was beautiful. And by the end of the episode, as we all know, Mark/Steven is shot by Harrow. And we're in a psych ward and we're met by the goddess Tarwet.
Yes.
The hippopotamus.
We don't know that at that point, but she does. She comes in. She says, hi. And then we get that's probably one of my favorite. Just memes from the show so far has been those two just screaming. There's the moment where Mark runs into Steven for the first time
And they're happy to see each other.
They're separate bodies. They're actually really happy to see each other. That's the first time we see them like, oh my God, I'm actually not really bummed that I have this altar here.
No, I didn't see that twist coming. Didn't. But then we find out going into episode 5 that it's the afterlife.
Yes, we think he's in an asylum. We're left to think that something happens. He gets transported into some place and surrounded by people that we've seen in the show before. But no, we find out that he's actually being weighed. His heart is being weighed against the feather to get into the afterlife.
Yep. If you know anything about ancient Egypt, yeah, your heart has to be lighter than a feather in order to make it to the field of reeds. And that's what the scales on Harrow's wrist represents. And he's prejudging all those people, essentially.
And I like that has been very prime imagery for this show.
Yes.
Has been Anubis and the scales being mm-hmm. balanced.
Very much so. And you find out that Tarouet is there to basically guide him to the afterlife, whether he's going to join the unbalanced souls in the Duat, which is the sands along the way, and or if he will make it onto the field of reeds. And so, and her, the scales are still going nuts because he's completely unbalanced.
And she mentions at this point, when they talk about the afterlife, someone goes, well, that's the afterlife. That's it. And she does kind of go on to say that it is one version of the afterlife.
And she mentions the ancestral plane, which we saw in Black Panther. So
when they take the heart-shaped herb, heart-shaped fruit,
heart-shaped herb.
Yeah.
Yep. And you see T'Challa talking with his father. So that is cool in the sense that that ties all of the various religions and beliefs in the Marvel universe together. So if you're Asgardian, Valhalla is real. That would be another plane. We know about the astral plane. If you're a Catholic like Matt Murdock, we know heaven is real. So they're all different planes of the afterlife. So really ties all of that together in a connective tissue, which is really awesome.
It's nice because the way they've been using the connective tissue to the rest of the MCU has been very, they've been very picky with it.
Yes.
So every time they do a little reference to something like that, not only is it a sly little reference to Black Panther, but it does tell you there's a ton of different versions of the afterlives of the religions, just like you said.
And so we're going to jump back a little bit into what goes on in the episode and talk about those themes. But Tarouet basically tells Steven and Mark that the scales need to balance for you to make it onto the afterlife. And that you basically have to be truthful with one another because something's not being shown to each other. And they have to take a stroll down a memory lane or memory hall. What would you call it? Memory asylum. Let's call it memory asylum.
A mental psych ward. And that's the name of the episode is very telling of exactly what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's asylum. Mm-hmm. You learn that. Well, the easiest way, Tarouet explains that the easiest way for it to be to be perceived by them, it's their perception of where they are. The asylum is entirely metaphorical. It's in their mind.
It is. And she even mentions, I haven't seen an asylum before, but.
And hey, I love in that moment, whatever. Mark does kind of freak out. He's like, oh, sure. Yep. Okay. The talking hippo, the magic, all of that, that's fine. But the fact that we're in an asylum, that's the weird part.
Yep. Pretty much. Exactly.
But the theme is they're secrets.
They're secrets. And they basically stroll down memory lane together and go through various memories. One of the first ones is they go into a room with just a bunch of dead bodies chilling in a cafe. And Mark starts looking at all these people and realizes that it's people that he's killed as Moon Knight because Khonshu ordered it. And then they're greeted by a child, and Steven chases after it. Well, Mark's like, no, let's not do that. Please don't.
And Steven's like, why is there a child in a room full of people you've killed?
Yeah.
I like that line. That stuck with me.
And that leads down to Steven discovering a lot about Mark's past, like the nitty gritty and all of that. So Mark is the main personality and Steven is an alter. That's what you learned from this. Going down memory lane, the next memory we see is Mark as a kid with his younger brother, Randall, and his family. And this is tragic. Corey and I were briefly talked about how tragic this is.
This is a really emotional episode. It picks you up from the get-go and says, hold on.
Hold on. You might need to go to the psych ward after this.
And we find out that they were two kids, you know, just kind of chilling, enjoying life. They were brothers.
Yeah, and Mark took his younger brother, Randall, to a cave to play, where he ultimately died in the cave. He drowned in the cave, and there was nothing he could do to stop it, which just puts a downward spiral on his entire family life from there on as a young kid. The next scene is absolutely heartbreaking for me.
The kid's playing at
the funeral.
The funeral.
Oh my, it's the funeral for his brother Randall, and Mark comes downstairs, and his mom's just, you could tell, distraught, but she sees him come down the stairs and it's just basically, what are you doing here? This is your fault. This is your fault.
You were supposed to take care of him. The wrong child died.
In front of everybody.
And that's how Mark is treated from that point on.
By his mother. And you watch his father just kind of be passive and a fly on the wall to the situation.
You know, he's kind of trying to like make Mark feel a little bit better, but there's not much that he can really do.
What did you think of the imagery of him? Every level he goes up in the house in the memory is another memory.
Is he's a little bit older. He's experiencing more and more of this trauma. It very much gave me the same vibe as the WandaVision.
Yes.
Preseason finale. What is that called? The penultimate episode.
Yes. Where he's
really taking a harsh look at all the traumas that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven is watching this as an outside eye.
Yeah.
He doesn't know any of this. He doesn't remember any of these scenarios.
Not at all. And it's really tragic because it flashes forward to two birthdays. And in the first one, Mark's sitting there at the table with ready to blow the candles out, and Dad's calling for his mom to come down the stairs, and she doesn't, and Dad just makes an excuse for her. And then the third one, Corey, take it away, because I don't know if I could talk about the next memory.
The next one it's the birthday party, it's a smaller cake, it's less, you know, pomp. And then his mom comes over, she's got a nice tall glass of something, you got to assume alcoholic, nice day drinking on the kid's birthday, and she basically just lays into him the same kind of, you know, oh, your brother probably would have liked a birthday party if he were alive.
You were always jealous of him. You were always jealous of him and things like that. And Mark freaks out and runs upstairs to his room.
Stuff that our kid doesn't want to hear.
Especially when he witnessed his brother die.
Now, you know, sidebar for a second here. You haven't seen Peacemaker yet, but...
No, I have not.
The arc in this... very, very much mirrors some of the things that happen in the Peacemaker show. And both times they have pulled emotions out of me watching like a child who, yeah, kids play in places they shouldn't. Things happen. He doesn't need to be, you know, reminded of all that. And I understand as a mother what I could never imagine what a mother would be going through.
No, I can't imagine either.
But that's, you know, not what Mark needed to hear at that time.
And in the memory, young Mark runs upstairs and slams the door shut to his bedroom. And Steven tries to go in, but present day Mark in the afterlife is trying to pull him away. And he's like, no, you don't need to go in there. You don't need to go in there. Well, eventually they do go in there. And like, this is the big theme of this episode. And it essentially, he stopped him. Mark stopped Steven from watching the moment the Steven altar was created. Watching the moment. The whole time, Steven's like, why are you remembering her like that? She wasn't like that. Well, they go back to the room so they can see the memory to ultimately balance the scales. And the altar of Steven takes over for what must be the first time in Mark's memory. And Mom comes in, angry, distasteful, hateful of Mark, and starts beating him.
Dr. Steven Grant has no fear. Mm-hmm. And he's just a little kid who's repeating that. And that was just harsh. I know some people, I've grown up around people who have been victims of child abuse, and it's a very, very hard topic to talk about.
Marvel is talking about it. And they're doing it very well. Obviously, it's got the Marvel flair. It is dramatized, but it is pretty well known and studied that alters form as a way to deal with trauma, physical, emotional, mostly sexual, but we don't want to get into that on this podcast. But it is known that to form from physical trauma as a child. And you learn in the conversation that between Mark and Steven, that Mark created Steven as a way to deal with what his mother put him through. And he even says that to Mark, to Steven, that, look, you got to live a normal, happy life. You didn't have to deal with that. That's why I created you, so that some part of us could have a normal, happy life, which goes to show that Mark has a real understanding of the situation he's in.
He does. He, throughout the episode, you get Mark is going, I know exactly what it is that I'm hiding. I know exactly what it is I'm running from, but I'm not giving you the satisfaction. You're going to have to work it out of me.
Another memory. And so you learn that the Steven altar was created because of the trauma induced by his mother, and that his father did nothing to stop it. Eventually we see, flashing forward a bit, we see the night that Khonshu saved his life and he became Khonshu's Moon Knight, which was awesome to see. And Khonshu, even Mark, talks to him and says, oh, you are broken.
Yep. Yep. He says, look at you. So much potential is like fractured, broken. Yep. And it harkens back to what Harrow says like three episodes ago. Did Khonshu choose you because your mind was easy to break or because it was already broken? Just a lot of parallels. This show is very much paying attention to itself, and I love that.
Exactly.
But yeah, you find out that Steven was created to be the soft, the child, the everything that his mother loved about his brother, you had said before we recorded. And that is absolutely heartbreaking. That's the childhood of Mark Spector is Steven Grant.
And you see it crash around Steven as well, that I thought I was the original all this time. He says that to Mark, and Mark goes into the, you were created to out of that. He's very, like I said, conscious of what is going on the whole time with the altar. And then flashing forward again, we learn when Mark started to lose control of the two alter himself and his alter Steven.
Yes, he gets the news that his mother died, and he goes to the Shiva. He's there.
Yes,
but he doesn't go in, and his father does like the little like the beckon, like
come outside on, the son. Window. Like, yep.
Come on. There's nothing that I could have done or did for you, but like maybe this is the closure that you need. And Mark just
that's
says
the moment.
Nope.
And that's and he walks begins to walk down the street, and that's the moment when their lives and blend together, when they bleed together, and that's when he loses control, where he talked about earlier in the episodes. I thought you had this under control. Yeah, I did too until just recently, and that was the trigger.
So he was already working for Khonshu at that point. That's the understanding of it. He's already been working doing that.
But that was 2 months before the events of Moon Knight.
Yes.
So for 2 months, the personalities have been freely going in between each other, essentially.
And I'm curious about leading up to that, because Steven just wakes up, and at this point, so we know by the time we get to the start of the show, Steven has just woken up random places a bunch of times before this, and it's just first thing he does is call his mom. Hey, mom.
Yep.
You know,
and that's where we get the latest gaitest thing from, because that's what
in a wild crocodile she used to say that. But
yes, the whole
what an episode.
If you don't want to have your emotions not played with, essentially, if you don't want to feel vulnerable, if you don't want to be upset, don't watch this episode. That's really what it comes down to. I mean, the whole thing is to balance the scales of Mark Spector and Steven, and they just take you on this emotional ride. This episode was unbelievable, and I love what they're doing. This Corey, you said it, with every new MCU television series that comes out on Disney Plus, you feel like, oh, this one's now my favorite. But for me, this is ultimately my favorite.
They each raise the bar a little bit, I think. Yeah, I will say, out of them, to me, Falcon and the Winter Soldier kind of feels like kind of lowest on the totem pole, but that's a totally different conversation.
Okay. I see. I would rank that higher than, for me, it's Loki, but that's a different conversation. See,
I like Loki a little bit more. So that's an episode to have. But one of the biggest things about that episode that I really enjoyed was in between going back and learning about Mark, we have these bits of him with Dr. Harrow.
Yes.
And this is a bit that I want to talk about, because we have Mark. Mark is the one who's interacting with him throughout most of the episode. And then about, at what point does Steven come through? Is that at the, when his mom passes away?
When he's confronted with the fact that his mom's dead.
Yes. And that is, you hit the nail on the head. The moment where, you know, Harrow goes to call her and is like, here, you know, talk to her. And he has to come to that realization of, oh, shoot. But there's another scene in there.
But let's go back to the scene where Steven Alter comes through. The first thing he does is call his mom. But when you look at the phone, he's not calling anybody.
No, he just picks it up. He doesn't like dial anything. That just makes it even more sad.
Yeah. If you think back to all the other episodes where Steven would be calling his mom, it doesn't look like he's talking to anybody on the phone. Not in the slightest.
He's just kind of talking it out.
Yep.
But in those moments where he's talking to Harrow, you see that the room that they're in is the room where they found the sarcophagus and the tomb of Alexander the Great. And Steven even says, like, wow, this is really familiar. In those sequences, we see Mark, we see Steven. But then there's a third one that I think we should talk about.
Because we see the sequence of the sarcophagus.
Yeah, I think we should talk about in episode 4 how there's that third tomb, that sarcophagus, that they just run completely past.
That's shaking, trying to escape. Mm-hmm. And that would be Jake.
I think so.
The third altar that neither one of them apparently knows about.
No. And I'm wondering if, with the context of this episode, there was the altar that Mark created that was to preserve the childhood. That was to preserve the innocence.
And also run away. Exactly. It was the runner, essentially.
So my theory moving forward is that this other, you know, this second altar for Mark is the one that was, you know, where all that violence got put into. Someone who's going to take that and then turn around and put that in onto the world.
I will get behind that theory. But I have to say this. I don't think we're going to really see that altar by the end of the season.
If we do see it, it's going to be like one of the last scenes of this final episode. Like,
yes, I think that what they're doing is they're dropping the little hints and clues to Jake, but we won't address it until either a second season or a movie.
And in a very Marvel way, like we're going to put these little breadcrumbs in here, 'cause we know we're going to pick them up later. But you see in that scene where he's talking to Harrow and he's got the broken nose. He talks about how, you know, you're starting fights in my hospital. He picks up the object to go and stab some of the orderlies. That's not Steven or Mark. Even the accent he uses is a little different.
Like, a little deranged.
Doctor, you know.
Yeah, it's a little different, but it's still Steven Mark in control. But I think that the other altars bleeding through, if that's what we can call it. So I also want to highlight that every time the altars change, you see the eyes roll back in the head. I think that's a really nice touch throughout the series to say, they're switching. Here you
go. And they do that really well in the early episode. And I don't know if that's actually like a real thing with DID.
I don't know either.
It makes me want to learn about it, which again, kudos to Marvel for having a wonderful superhero story that you know, works with ancient Egypt and all that. But at the core of it, at the very foundation of this show, is a story about a man suffering from a mental illness and having to learn how to deal with that and how to find himself. The real moment of this episode that got me emotionally is when Steven looks at Mark and says, "It's not your fault, mate. It's not your fault. You were a kid. The things she said to you, the things that she did to you, you couldn't have done anything."
In all of Mark's life, he, no matter what, feels like it is his fault. He feels like it is his fault that Randall died. I should have never taken him to that cave. But it just, so much emotion was built up, and you have to give it up for Oscar Isaac.
100%.
This is one of those roles that as an actor, I feel like you dream of, where you get to explore so many different things in one character. You're exploring different characters within one character. And it just seems like if someone who's a serious actor, this is the dream come true when it comes to that sort of thing.
Have you seen the movie Fight Club? I think we've talked about this very briefly.
A very long time, to the point where I barely remember it.
And it's interesting to go for that movie does essentially, spoiler for like, I think it's like a 20, almost 30 year old film. In that movie, the main character does have dissociative identity. And the way that it's told in the movie, it's two different people who are these personalities.
Yep.
Or these two, you know, halves of the same person. And It's so interesting to see it done by Oscar in this movie, because being the same person, he is one actor, you can tell exactly which of the alter. You can tell when he's Mark. You can tell when he's Steven.
Doesn't matter what he's wearing. Doesn't matter. You can just tell in an instant. They don't have to utter a line. It's all in the face. Mm-hmm. It's everything is there in his eyes and his mouth. Like, he just embodies the two characters of Steven and Mark so perfectly.
And then, you know, and that brings us to Steven and Mark are fighting the souls that are trying to pull them into the sand at the end.
To the Duat.
And they're about to pull Mark down, and Steven saves him. Steven tackles the guy off the edge of the, you know, Mark finally hit a place where he doesn't need Steven anymore. And Steven hits the point where he can protect someone.
Yes.
And they fall off the boat. And you have that.
Steven falls off the boat. Yeah. Steven prevents Mark from falling, and Steven falls into the Duat and becomes basically frozen in the sand. That's where the episode ends. And they're trying at it. This is all happening because scales didn't get balanced in time because they were trying to get to Horus or Anubis's gate. Well, I can't remember which. I think it was Anubis, right?
You're better at the names than me. They were going for one in the first place. And then there was a brief intermission where they go and they check in with,
They weren't going necessarily. They were trying to get to the field of reeds.
Originally, yes.
And then they convince Tarawet.
There's that moment where you see all the souls. Ahmed is being out. Where we see Layla and Harrow, this entire episode and the last episode were all Mark and Steven. So this goes to show you that when Mark does eventually come back to the real universe, Harrow's like winning. Ahmed is free, and he's going to have to do some work to get Khonshu back, to get back into the suit, and it's from there.
Tarawet even says something's wrong because these souls are being trudged prematurely and thrown right into the Duat, and you just see them falling. So they have to escape, and she's instead of taking them to the Field of Reeds, she alters course to take them to a gate that would lead them back against her better judgment. Everything she knows, I should say.
Which is kind of cool, seeing a human change the fate of God.
The reason why the souls of the Duat are coming after them is because the scales didn't balance before they got to the gate.
Yes, because they couldn't reconcile.
But the moment that Steven is turned to stone in the sands, the scales balance.
And that's when he enters.
And then Mark enters the Field of Reeds. It's a beautiful episode. The themes, it's traumatic, it's sad, I love everything about it. This is by far, if I'm going to pick one episode in all of the MCU properties on Disney Plus, the streaming and the shows, this is the episode that they've done the best with.
I was going to say that. Yep. I would 100% agree. It's not like the big action-y explosion set pieces and dramatic everything. It's a story of, essentially deep down, one man coming to terms with himself.
Yes, very self-aware man. He's very self-aware. Yeah, you could say what you will about Mark and the things that Khonshu's had him do and the things he's been involved in, but he's very self-aware of Steven and all of that.
He tries to protect Steven at any point, at any cost. Like, I'll tell you everything that's going on. Just don't go in that room.
Yep.
And then Steven ends up protecting him in the end.
It's deep. It's really deep.
So, assuming Mark got dragged down and Steven didn't, that would just be it. That would be the end. We're not going to get like Steven taking over the body fully.
We might. We don't know. I mean,
it's interesting. It raises questions.
It raises a lot of questions. What's going to happen when Mark does come back through to the world of the living? Because that's what they were trying for. His scales balanced. He got to the field of reeds. But they were also at the gate.
But if he's in the field of reeds, that means he's dead. He got to where he's going. That means that he's dead. He's in the afterlife. How can he come back? He's going to have to give up that life of happiness, that finally coming to terms with himself and go back and save people. And I don't know how he's going to pull that off. That's the trick of episode six.
And his relationship with Khonshu is going to be wild, I think.
Because now he sees, and there's another scene. Steven tells him, he played you all along when they go to the thing. He was after you the whole time. And I think we're going to get Mark versus Moon Knight with the power of Moon Knight. I don't know how that's going to work.
I don't know. It's going to be very interesting and set up a lot of conflicts because, you know, ultimately, even though Mark and Steven have come to terms with each other, Mark is going to try to get Steven back.
There's no way he can't.
Yeah.
There's no way he.
There's no way he doesn't try.
Exactly. There's no way that he can't move on without Mark now that he's
without Steven.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. No, there isn't. They've come to terms with each other and their shared past in that, and they are coming to a mutual understanding and respect of each other. So, moving forward, he's going to deal with Harrow. That being said, is the dealing with Harrow, is that going to be the brunt of, that's going to be the end of this season? Is getting Steven back what's going to be what goes on in the next Moon Knight project? And that's how Jake comes into play, is because he's striving to get the other altar back. And the third one comes out.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. Like, we get rid of Steven, who has been the most relatable of, I would say, the characters so far.
Yes.
We get rid of him. This final episode, Mark has to do whatever he has to do to get back to Khonshu, to get the powers back and everything. Then and discovers... Yeah, I really do see like the final scene, maybe the second to final scene of the episode being, what the hell do we do now? And then a third, you know, someone else comes out, Jake, and says, well, now we're going to have to do this. And then
or cut camera, something like that.
And then the next day we get an announcement from Disney saying, oh, Moon Knight season 2, it is confirmed.
Well, will we get it the next day? Because this rolls right into our next talking point. Do the events of this show tie into Multiverse of Madness in any way on screen? Because this is ending the day before Multiverse of Madness is released, or in some cases the day of, because it's releasing on Wednesday at midnight.
I don't know. I don't know how it could, unless the Egyptian gods are somehow tied into the realities of the Marvel Universe.
One of them could be tied into the Illuminati in the MCU.
Which is very possible.
That we don't know where this is going to go. It's called the multiverse. So you have to imagine we're going to be seeing some of the other planes too.
I would hope so, that they address that.
This movie is going to be a lot bigger than we ever realized, I think.
And I really, really am excited about that, because I've been starving myself of any ads, any trailers. Nope.
I was forced to watch another trailer on it because it was in the previews for Secrets of Dumbledore when I saw that last week.
You did see that. Do you want to take a little aside and talk about that? I know you did.
I don't want to talk about that. If you're interested in my thoughts on Fantastic Beasts and the Secrets of Dumbledore, please check out the review that I put up earlier this week. It's called The Dumbledores and Their Naughty, Naughty Secrets.
Ooh, sounds scandalous. I'm going to have to watch all three of those movies just to listen to your take.
My one takeaway, and I'll leave you all with this for this episode of the podcast, is it leaves the Fantastic Beasts series, even though it shouldn't be called Fantastic Beasts anymore, in a much better place than The Crimes of Grindelwald did. Say what you will about, you know, certain plot points and things like that, This one really tied up some serious loose ends, left of quite a few itself, but and was confusing at times. But again, like I said in my review, it was purposely confusing, so you have to go into it with that knowledge. It was very good. Mads Mikkelsen's fantastic. It's worth the watch. The fight scenes are incredible. The best fights in the magical world we've ever seen. I mean, you're seeing things.
That's a big claim.
Well, but before I wrap this point up, in the mainline Harry Potter movies, what did we get? We got mostly wizards throwing clear spells at each other and deflecting
them. Up until Lord of the Phoenix, yeah.
But even then, it wasn't much more than deflecting spells and then occasionally Expelliarmus and Avada Kedavra meeting in the center. That was it. This, you're seeing things like them using, you know, artful dodging, essentially, just getting out of the way, using things like the high ground, their surroundings.
The high ground?
Yes, the high ground. It's over, Anakin! No, yeah. And so, fantastic to watch. Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore. Go check it out. It doesn't deserve all the hate it's getting, especially when you consider where the rest of the movies are heading.
Is Eddie Redmayne, is he still, like, the main character?
He's the main character. I will say, and Ari and I talked about this at one point, he is the main character in a story that is about Albus Dumbledore. That is what the Fantastic Beasts movies are.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I can understand that.
It's about, the Fantastic Beasts movies are really about Dumbledore's past and things he's had to deal with, dealing with Gellert Grindelwald, but told from the perspective of what Newt has to go through.
Okay. You know what? That makes a lot of sense.
But moving forward, we got Multiverse of Madness next week after the Moon Knight season finale.
I'm so excited. I'm going to see this that movie's in the Cinemark. I'm ready.
I think this is going to be bigger than No Way Home. I'm going to come out in there. My brother and I have talked about this. No Way Home was huge, but it was still a fairly self-contained story in a lot of ways. Like, it had mostly to do with Peter Parker.
It's a Spider-Man story at its core, regardless of how big it spans with other Spider-Mans. This is like a Marvel movie.
This affects the Marvel universe as a whole.
I'm curious to see how it goes.
I think for that reason, it's going to be a bigger movie. And I think we slept on this movie a lot because everyone was so excited for No Way Home. And that was what everyone was biting at the bit for.
The moment they said that Wanda was going to be in it, that Scarlet Witch was going to be, I'm pretty sure they have said that she's the antagonist or she's just...
They haven't confirmed.
They haven't said either way.
I think, and the theories that I'm seeing is that she is the ultimate villain of this.
One version of her or another, I could see. Absolutely.
Something along those lines.
Did you watch all of What If?
No.
I would recommend. I feel like someday we got to take an afternoon and just watch those.
I watched the Doctor Strange one, and it seems like the What If Doctor Strange is coming into effect.
Yeah, he seems like the most important one.
And again, it looks like for somebody like Benedict Cumberbatch that this is going to be one of those things that's a role that if you're a good actor, you're going to love. Sorry about that, guys. Thank God my computer has battery power because the power flashed for a second and it caused us to pause our talking, even though we continued the conversation.
There was a moment of shared concern. Like, is that it? Do we start over?
Did we get screwed? No, we're good. Everything's good. We got phantom power. We're good.
We're all set here, Porkins. For those of you who don't get that at home, I have a little 3¼-inch Porkins figure with me on
attached
the mic
to
today.
His mic.
Yeah, just
attached
for a little motivation.
And he's got R2-D2 with him.
A little R2-D2. Well, I was going through, if you've seen on our Instagram, I've been going through my collection lately, just trying to pick out some favorites, because we got some stuff going on that we're planning coming down the tube, Dorkside-wise. And I figured I'd bring a couple of cool things today, and one of them was this Empire Strikes Back R2. He's all muddy, and he makes a little... Well, okay, the battery hasn't been changed since, like, 2006, so...
There's no amount of editing I can do to make it so you hear that.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that.
But moving on from Multiverse...
Speaking of Marvel, we've got Multiverse of Madness coming, and then we finally, since our last episode, got a trailer for...
Thor, Love, and Thunder.
What can I say except...
Other than, whoa, oh, oh, sweet child of mine...
Yeah, I did not expect that. That felt more like a Guardians of the Galaxy kind of like trailer song. But then you think about what Ragnarok did. think about how Thor is with the Guardians of the Galaxy for what looks like not as much of this film as we may have originally thought.
Yeah, so they're not the Asgardians of the Galaxy.
Asgardians of the Galaxy.
No, but there were a lot of things in here that I liked. Obviously, the big thing is you see the mighty Thor, who is Jane Foster, wielding Mjolnir. That's the biggest thing.
Yes, and people were getting all upset about that. Like, they're just trying to bring Natalie Portman back. They had Lady Thor in the comics. It's been a thing for years. Relax. She's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, she's pretty cool. You see, if you look closely, you'll see that you're in Olympus and you get a and you see Zeus. Mm-hmm. He's holding a lightning bolt. So that means Hercules is probably in this movie.
Which is great because now in Marvel canon, we've had Thor. We've had references to things. But we now have Egyptian gods. We have Greek gods.
Greek gods.
We've got Norse.
What else is next? What's next?
A whole bunch. I mean, we got Eternals and stuff like that. There's a whole lot.
I didn't see Eternals, so I still can't talk about it. Yeah. That's just me.
You're not missing too much. But Jane Foster, who is there wielding a specific hammer.
Jonathan?
Yeah?
Well, hold on. I want to say right now, I'm going to put my theory on the table that she was always worthy to wield Mjolnir. She was always worthy, and that's how she has it. Because we remember, last time we saw Mjolnir, it was cracked by Hela in the location of New Asgard.
And that's why I'm thinking that she ended up finding Mjolnir after Hela destroys it in the beginning of that movie.
I think she finds it in New Asgard. She goes to there looking for Thor after the snap, after the blip.
Oh.
Yeah.
And that's what she's been doing the whole time, trying to find what happened to Thor.
And think about it. No one can pick up the pieces to Mjolnir because they're not worthy.
I never thought about that. Who picks up the pieces of Mjolnir? They'd have to be worthy.
And I feel like that Jane Foster is worthy, so the hammer, in a way, reforges itself.
The moment she touches it, and like a tink, 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 it all comes back together in her hand, and kind she's of, like, what?
Because remember, when Odin banishes Thor, he whispers to Mjolnir, if they are worthy, they can wield the power of Thor.
Now, this has got to be frustrating as hell to Thor. Because in just the span of, I would imagine, a few months, he's seen Cap pick up his hammer and be worthy. He's seen Jane Foster pick up his hammer and be worthy. And
hold
even
on, time
he
out
goes
real
through
quick.
The, like, worrying about if he's worthy. Yeah, I'm getting the timeout from the coach. What up?
I just want to say this, guys. At the time of this recording, we've passed the 3-year mark on the anniversary of Cap wielding Mjolnir. Time in.
Literally one of the coolest scenes I've ever seen in a theater.
Three years.
Like, Homecoming was, not Homecoming, No Way Home was big. I just went through all of the different home titles of Spider-Man movies. It's confusing. I can't wait for them to retitle them. Like, Spider-Man was big. Like, the reactions when Toby and Andrew came through on the screen, I want to say maybe Andrew's was bigger.
We were at Endgame together.
We went to one of the end games. That movie 7 times in theaters.
I think
and
we
each
went to premiere together. I think we either went together or we didn't know we were going to the same showing. We ended up together and like in that theater when everyone collectively lost their damn minds.
I think so. Yeah, when he picks up that hammer. Whew, so seeing Jane Foster with it, everybody's picked up the hammer but Thor lately. He's got to be getting a little bit butthurt about that. And that's
he's
where
gotta
he's
be.
Like you said, on the adventure to become a more peaceful Thor.
Yes, and he even says that that in the trailer that all I've known is war. Maybe it's my superhero days are over.
And he even said, which movie does he say? My youth, I courted war. It's like Avengers 1 or something.
I think that might have been Ultron.
And it just goes to show you, like, the range that they have for this character can go from, look at Thor 1.
Oh,
and then look at where he is now going.
Isn't it called Allspeak? Isn't that what the Asgardian speak is, Allspeak? And wherever they are, it just translates to what the people are hearing? Something like that.
That's why he can understand Groot.
So, exactly. And there's a theory out there that the reason why the tone has shifted and it works canonically instead of just changing directors and writers and whatnot
Stop.
You're going the wrong way. Is that he spent more time around people from Earth and the rest of the galaxy that his Allspeak is now adapting to what's actually happening. That's why in the first Thor, he's very like regal and Norse and whatnot.
He's only dealt with that his entire life.
That's the last time he was on Earth. Well, was in that dark Middle Ages period with Norse paganism and stuff like that.
That's, so he, okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, like he's it picking adapted. It up and he's yes. learning. He's
it. He's it speaking makes sense this-
because he's been around for like what 5,000 years, and yeah. in the last like span from Avengers to Thor Ragnarok, he's gone through so much change in like what
yep.
5 years over 5,000 for a god.
Yeah.
He's got to be able to adapt. And,
yes.
And
that's the canonic. More. That's the theory I'm seeing online that works with the MCU canon. And I like that.
Okay. Yeah. I like that too.
One of the other things okay. I love about this.
I like it. Picasso.
I love that. Again, we're redesigning the Thor costume. I love the blue and gold accoutrements and everything. I really like the color scheme that they've got going on.
I like when he's wearing the Ravager outfit. Just oh, one yeah, of the Guardians.
He looks like straight up 80s rock star. Yep. 80s rock star, and I love it. I'm sitting there like, is Axl Rose, and are they going to pop out with Slash and whatnot? Just like,
and that's what the poster sets up too. He's like, he's standing there, he's holding the Stormbreaker with the lightning. Like, it feels like an album cover from some.
It looks like Spinal Tap. Yeah. Spinal Tap is what
it
I
looks
think.
Like. Some kind of like, okay, we're going 80s. It's the same kind of feel as Ragnarok, and I really
one of
love
the things that
Ragnarok.
I thought was really cool is there's a brief clip in that trailer of him on the longship with Stormbreaker at the front pushing a Bifrost out in front of it.
Because as we hear in Avengers: Infinity War, it can summon the Bifrost.
Yes, and he uses it.
He does use that again as well.
And his eyes are both blue. So did he get because he's been able to summon the Bifrost? Does he now have something similar to what Heimdall had, where he can see? Throughout,
so he's got all sight, all speak. He technically is the All Father now that Odin is dead.
Yeah, technically, yeah. So just
Thor's
a theory,
got it all.
Just a theory, because if you look, he's got blue eyes again, not one of each. So it's just a theory. I'm looking forward to this because I think Multiverse is going to have cataclysmic events unfold that affect the entire universe, and I think that by the time we get to Thor: Love and Thunder, those events will have caused Thor to come back into the fight, so to speak. Also, in the trailer, did you notice there's a scene where Thor and Korg are standing there looking up?
Yeah, and Korg's wearing like a Hawaiian shirt or something, isn't he?
That, but if you look at that scene, it seems like another classic bait and switch from Marvel.
It looks like they're leaving him there, but there's an empty space.
There's an empty space. I think it's Beta Ray Bill.
Really?
Yes, because if you remember, Beta Ray Bill was the original wielder of Stormbreaker in the comics.
Well, plus if they're about to do a Spider-Man No Way Home of Thor and have a bunch of different Thor characters running around, it kind of makes sense. Beta Ray Bill is one of those. And for those of you who don't know much about Beta Ray Bill in the comics, I am with you and cannot explain much either.
I'm with you as well. I only know bits and pieces.
I know, but it's just... Wasn't it just like a horse that got the power of Thor or something?
I don't know.
Or something like that?
I think it's a
horse. I'm offending Marvel fans. I'm so sorry. But you actually see the head of Beta Ray Bill on the tower in Thor Ragnarok, where they live, that tower.
Yes, actually, because he's one of the past champions of the Grand Master.
So he's canon already.
And that's the theory is that it's Beta Ray Bill. Is there and it could work because we see Sakaar briefly in the trailer too.
That's the thing with Marvel trailers is I'm trying on the one hand not to watch too many of them before the thing comes out because I don't want to get spoiled. And I think Marvel is aware of that, and that's why they keep doing these beautiful tricks in the trailers of like some scenes aren't even in there. Some scenes are a little bit modified.
With little hints that there's something else going on, like we saw in the No Way Home trailer when Spidey's swinging in to fight
Lizard's head gets kicked. It was like in one trailer they released in Brazil and it was like 2 seconds longer and everybody's like, that's all the Spider-Man.
Yeah. So I think they know it. I think they know what they're doing. They know they can't hide everything. So they're trying to leave little breadcrumbs for everybody to figure it out to get them excited.
I'm down.
Let's go for it.
Yeah, I'm down for it. I'll take it. What's next on the Marvel docket after? Well, we're still doing. How about the CrossFit?
CrossFit.
Thor in the chains. It looks like he's working off his Endgame body.
Yep. Which, by the way, from the original photos that were released, the original set photos, Hemsworth looks yoked beyond Hemsworth levels. Like
he's a Hemsworth, he can only get more Hemsworthian as he goes. At some point, the guy's going to turn into a literal freaking god.
I mean, but he's bigger. He's even bigger than he was, and he was already massive. Like, did you see the set photo I'm talking about where it was just like him standing there like this at the end in a black and white photo and his arms are just massive?
Oh, yeah.
I'm like they were not that big in the previous
movie. Dude, his arm looks like the size of Vin Diesel's head.
Yeah.
Big.
Massive. So, he just using chains in front of the giant dead creature that...
Now, was that the lair of Surtur?
No, I don't know.
I don't know. It seems like one of those movies where they're going to kind of dive a little bit into the past.
It's going to be interesting to see.
There's the scene with Quill. Quill's talking about when you're around the people, when you have the people you love looking in their eyes. Yeah.
And Thor just leans in and he's trying to get in front of Quill as he's looking at the rest of his crew.
I can't wait to see how those two act together.
I think this is going to be fantastic. I think this is going to have that Ragnarok feel that became everybody's favorite movie.
I really do think that he's not going to be with the Guardians for more than a third of this movie. I think they're going to get tired of his shiz and they're going to like leave him somewhere. And Korg will come too.
We saw him, big guy, not that good looking.
Spider-Man in the background looking, what? Not that good. Have you seen? He's a literal god.
Well, yeah, Chris Hemsworth is a literal god.
Not wrong. Something about the Hemsworth genes. I don't know.
I don't know either. Oh, but beyond that, guys, in this last week, we got a little bit of other news. We've got Cassian Andor, the Cassian Andor series, which we still haven't seen anything on, already has been confirmed to start filming of season 2 this November.
I have been waiting for this show since I was 6 years old.
Pretty much. That's what it feels like. But they've all talked about how Andor's actually going to have big ramifications for the Star Wars universe.
Good, because they can do a lot with the Rebel Alliance here that we don't get to do that in a lot of other Star Wars.
No, it's the shady side of the Alliance.
Yes. It's the like
how it formed in the nitty gritty, and that's the big thing that we're going to get from this. There's rumors that they're going to try with the release of Fallen Order 2 coming up later this year, supposedly.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Exactly. That they're going to try and tie Cal Kestis into the storyline, which I could see a way that it works because he's in the galaxy right now. And there is a way it works. Cameron Mahomes has been to Disney and they confirmed the Fallen Order lightsaber with him. So I think they are trying to work it in. I do.
That's the thing. I like Cal Kestis so much.
Please don't tie him in.
I want them to use him sparingly, but I still want them to use him. And so I'd be down for that.
I'd be more happy for him to pop up in the Ahsoka series with Ezra.
Yes. That would be a better fit. He gets to be Jedi. I feel like if it's the time of the rebellion and he's interacting with Andor, I could see a scene where he's like laying low. He doesn't do any Jedi things. And we as fans just go, oh, holy shit, that's Cal Kestis.
Like
a scene, and that's the kind of stuff that they're more than happy to do.
Or they get intel from him. Something. That's what I'd be happier with. I'd rather him pop up in Ahsoka. And honestly, even put him and Ezra at odds would be interesting.
I do want to see, since the Disney acquisition, we've seen a bunch of Jedi who have survived Order 66 and survived past the time, we don't know about Cal or Ezra surviving past Return of the Jedi, but it's kind of implied. If you have a run-in with Vader before Return of the Jedi and you survive, you kind of like seem like fair game later on.
Yes, absolutely. You know, speaking of Jedi that survived, I want to throw this out there. Yeah, we saw Plo Koon get shot down, but do you think he survived that?
If you ask Dave Filoni, he'll probably say, I think we can find ways around that. You know, if you don't see a character die on screen, did they really?
Did they?
So I could imagine. Did you see? I posted a TikTok. I've been reading through the art book, The Art of the Mandalorian Season 2, and they had the concept art of Plo Koon where Luke Skywalker was.
I'm glad it was Luke, but Plo Koon would have been cool too.
And now I feel like since people know that, it's such a red herring that if they do find a way to sneak Plo Koon in, and if they do, I guarantee it'll be in a Dave Filoni project.
I guarantee Dave Filoni will be the guy that had Plo Koon CGI'd onto himself.
Oh, no. That'd be funny. Yeah, no, I can see that.
Because he loves Plo Koon so much.
And so Filoni, correct me if I'm wrong, is directing the Ahsoka show. Like the whole thing of him directing Mandalorian was to get his feet wet for that.
I believe so. I believe that's why he directed episodes in Mandalorian, because he's been a fantastic animated director. He didn't do anything with live action. I believe that's part of the reason why they married Favreau and Filoni together, is because Favreau has both been involved in animated projects as well as directed live action and produced some of the biggest movies in the fandoms.
Right now, I got to say, Jon Favreau's got to be one of the most successful things to come out of.
I know. I need another
Disney at this moment.
All right, listen, I needed another season of his Chef show, because I loved that. Because that is one of my favorite movies he's ever done, was Chef, the movie. It's a lot of fun. He's the main character. He wrote it, directed, and produced it. It's an unbelievable movie. So I need him to do that too. I know he's got a lot on his plate, but I really need Chef to come back onto Netflix for another season.
I never watched that, but I have to. You had told me there was a couple of good episodes that I'd really like.
Yeah, Filoni's in it. Sam Raimi's in it.
The Filoni one I want.
Gwyneth Paltrow's in it.
Really?
Yeah. RDJ, Tom Holland, they make appearances in it.
Okay.
It's on Netflix. It's a cooking show. It's great. I love it. It's not even like a competition. It's just for the love of cooking, and I freaking love it.
That's something I'd throw on in the background.
Yeah, a lot of it takes place at his house, because he, after filming the movie Chef, he had a whole like professional kitchen put in at his house for himself.
I have seen Chef the movie. I did like that movie. It's really good.
So yeah, it's him and Roy Choi, who he worked with to get skills as a chef for that movie. He also, Wolfgang Puck, who's a big chef's in it, because he worked with Wolfgang briefly for part of his training. Great flick. Great show. It's a lot of fun, because it's just about food.
I keep learning things about Favreau, and I'm like, what a cool dude. Yeah. Like, I just want to sit and like listen to a D&D session that he's playing. Like,
yeah. Mr. Favreau, if you're listening, I love to cook. I would love to come to your house and cook with you. I don't even have to talk fandom. I'll just cook with you. That would be cool.
I'd want to talk fandom. I would talk his ear off.
Yeah,
I'd let him talk my ear off.
Yeah,
if you wanted
yeah,
to.
Yeah, that's why you're not invited.
Yeah,
because I'll work it in. But yeah, no. So Andor's got some big ties to everything. I think we're really going to see the formation of the rebellion with Bail Organa and all the rebels and stuff.
Jimmy Smits. If we get some Jimmy Smits back as Bail Organa, I'd be 100% down for that.
Some more Mon Mothma probably, and things like that. We don't really have anything on it, so I don't know what more to say about it other than if it's already greenlit for a second season, and apparently it's going to film for 18 straight months. So that was probably seasons 2 and 3.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's
why. Or they're just going to do like a ridiculously long season. They said how long the season is.
They haven't said anything. Do you even know about Andor season 1 yet? We know it's announced. We don't know when it's coming out.
Do you think we see K2SO?
I hope so.
I know K2SO's origin has already been explained in the comics. But
I hope so.
As we already know, they're not too worried about contradicting the comics in the shows if it benefits the story.
Exactly.
So if they have a cool, like, another way of retelling the story of K2SO and Cassian Andor coming together, I'd be down for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Bring him back.
There's a lot that they could do with the Andor series for sure. Kenobi.
We're less than a month away now.
They dropped, I can't remember what magazine. I don't think it was Entertainment. Might have been Icon or something. They dropped just a couple images. And, you know, I've been seeing fan art since like 2005 of more Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan Kenobi. But every time I see an official image, my nerd heart like starts beating a little bit faster.
But think
faster.
About this. It's
I
coming,
can't even speak.
It's coming out during Celebration.
Yes.
Star Wars Celebration is coming up, and I'm stoked. Like, this is where I'm like, the Star Wars projects that we've gotten lately on film and television, I'm stoked. And the video game. So hopefully we'll get an announcement about Fallen Order 2. That would make sense to drop it then.
I would like that.
The next couple Star Wars projects would be nice, because I've been seeing it all over the internet right now, is Kevin Feige took Marvel creators on a retreat where they're now planning out all of the Marvel products through 2032. So I would imagine that over at Lucasfilm, with Dave Filoni heading up the creative side of it, that's where we're heading, and we're going to get more things like that Bad Batch season 2.
Yes, I'm extremely excited for that.
I bet we'll get at least a trailer for that. Maybe not a true announcement for when it will be, because I feel as though animated shows might take a little bit longer to do everything, but that's just me.
That concerns me a little. So Kenobi comes out what day?
27th of May.
27th? When does Celebration start?
Starts the 25th.
So literally at the exact same time.
Yes, okay. That's why they pushed it back to, I think, so that they can announce some big things and put some stuff out just before Kenobi comes out.
Which is really strange because you would think that they would want all focus to be on Kenobi.
You would think.
You know, like the buzz of, unless those first episodes are like things that reveal stuff, that is in sync with.
So, okay, I take that back. It's not the 25th. It's Thursday, May 26th that Celebration starts, ending the 29th. But we get Kenobi on the 27th. It's so, yeah.
Could you imagine?
Oh my God, I wish we could go to Celebration.
Could you imagine Celebration? Like, it's the first one since COVID. Since PCT, yeah.
Yeah.
Pre-COVID times, for those who didn't know my act.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely the first one since then. This is going to be massive.
I think so. I think...
This is the time that if Lucasfilm wants to shoot its shot, shoot your shot.
And they've been kind of keeping quiet lately. You know, dropping stuff for sure here and there.
But say what you will about some of the directions Lucasfilm has gone, you have to give them credit at how well they keep things under wraps. They keep things under wraps better than Marvel.
They do.
They really do.
Nobody knew that Luke... I mean, they'll go so far as to take one character and completely change the concept art of them in like books and stuff leading up
and
to
call
it,
so. And even in like say Plo Koon walking in the script and whatnot, like they know how to, they really know what they're doing when it comes to keeping secrets. You got to give them credit for that.
Much better at it. I mean, Marvel's still pretty good. I mean,
well, absolutely.
Even though we saw the picture of Andrew Garfield going to be the leaked picture of him on the blue screen in the suit, nobody was 100% sure that they were going to be in that movie.
No, no one was.
But Star Wars, nobody knew about Grogu. Nobody. That was episode one. They
and
didn't
Dave
even
Filoni,
name the character until
Dave
season
Filoni,
two.
I mean, Jon Favreau was freaking out about that. Like, he even says, he's like, I'm just sitting there hoping that none of this gets leaked.
And every day checking the internet, like, oh God, oh God.
Yeah, you know that he's got it saved in his phone so that if it says Star Wars leak, he's instantly checking it.
Well, that's because Star Wars doesn't have Tom Holland.
Yeah, thank God.
Or Mark Ruffalo.
Thank God.
To leak everything.
They have so much discipline. Although, going back to when The Force Awakens came out, there was a bit on the Graham Norton show when The Force Awakens was announced and all that stuff with Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, and all those guys. And they were talking about the contracts they had to sign about keeping it quiet and whatnot. And John Boyega just chimes in. He's like, I told the cabbie as soon as I got the role. He's like, hey, mate, I've just been cast in Star Wars. And the guy just looks at me. He's like, all right. And I'm like, no, seriously, I did. And he's like, okay.
It's so sad because you could tell John Boyega, like, loves Star Wars. And I've seen a couple of, like, little videos, little interviews and stuff of him years later. And he's like, just kind of bummed.
Yeah.
Like, he likes it, but he's kind of like.
Same with Daisy Ridley.
It's not what it could have been.
I don't think she was as passionate of a fan, but I think she was so excited to be a part of such a big project, and she seems kind of bummed, and you haven't really heard much from them.
No. I mean, Oscar Isaac did pretty well. He's done X-Men Apocalypse.
I've told you he's one of the shining spots in that sequel trilogy, and it shows why he's a shining spot in that trilogy. He, in my opinion, is the Ewan McGregor of the sequel trilogy.
Poe?
Yes.
Or Oscar
yes.
Isaac?
Yes, because he's such a fantastic actor. You want to see him on that screen. He was one of the best parts in the movies.
Who talks first? You talk first? I talk first?
Yeah.
It's a good charismatic character, and he plays them very well. I still got to say, I think Adam Driver and Kylo Ren, the character isn't written as well as I'd like, but then again, Poe's a little somewhat. Actually, no, Poe's pretty consistent throughout
the movies. Yes. Adam Driver is still my pick for if they decide to reboot the Harry Potter movies themselves as Severus Snape.
Severus Snape.
And make it so that Tom Hiddleston is Remus Lupin.
Oh, so you're talking about young, like...
Yeah,
like while everybody was
getting
out of school?
I mean, well, technically speaking, James and Lily Potter are killed at the age of like 21. They're young.
They do not look 21 if you watch the movies.
No, and Snape's the same age, so he's supposed to be in his 30s at Hogwarts. But it's Alan Rickman, so yeah.
Well, you know.
Late 30s. Yeah, that's about where he's supposed to be.
I can see it. Like, should they reboot Harry Potter already?
I think
just get it done with. They could do it closer to the books.
Okay. Hear me out. Hear me out. Let Fantastic Beasts run its course. Course correct it. And then make an HBO series out of it.
I was totally kidding. I don't think there's much you can do in those, like, unless you reinvent the series completely.
And then you cast Bonnie Wright, who played Ginny, and Daniel Radcliffe as Lily and James.
Did you hear? I saw something on the news that Daniel Radcliffe is done playing Harry Potter. He wouldn't want to come back.
Yeah, no, I don't blame him. I mean, he had severe alcoholism problems during the filming of Half-Blood Prince, and he talks about it. He hates watching himself on screen in that movie because he was just drunk half the time.
You know, maybe that's why I hate the Half-Blood Prince, too.
Maybe.
I've never really cared for the book or the movie.
Maybe.
Some good moments, though. I like the Felix Felicis and everything. There's that. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
It's not my favorite. It's not as creepy when Harry does it then as when the priests do it in Moon Knight.
Oh, those clicky things. That was creepy as heck.
That was so creepy.
That was extremely odd.
What else we got there, Corey?
One more thing. There's Star Wars Tales of the Jedi.
I remember this being announced. I didn't really dive too far into it, but it's going to be an animated anthology series similar to, not in the sense of like Visions was, where it's a bunch of different studios telling entirely different stories. I think it's one studio telling all the different stories. So that should be interesting. You might get some Jedi heroics that we never heard about and add to the lore of the Jedi.
I'm cool with that. Depends on what time period they do it for.
I mean, they could do it in any time period if it's going to be an anthology. They could do it Old Republic, the High Republic, you know, what's going on during the Clone Wars of some of the different sects of Jedi.
Different Jedi leaders, yeah. You know? The Clone Wars are so big and there's so many Jedi.
Over 3 years, yeah.
Exactly. There's so many stories that they can tell that aren't like just the regular Clone Wars stories. I know like comics and stuff have kind of touched on those.
They could do stories from, you know, an apprentice that was adjacent to Obi-Wan, let's say, a Jedi youngling that was adjacent to Obi-Wan Kenobi. They could do cool things with that.
I feel like there was an old book series called Tales of the Jedi.
I don't remember. Couldn't really tell you.
No, but darn it, there was one other thing, Star Wars, that I was going to mention. But no, HBO Max, they just put on The Batman, which we talked about last week.
Yes,
and then The Batman has now confirmed a sequel.
That, which I'm very excited about. With Warner Brothers trying to, the new CEO of Warner Brothers trying to really say, look, we don't have connective tissue in our movies. We need that. He's looking for a Kevin Feige-esque character to head up the DC universe.
Yes, who and, I think should honestly be either Geoff Johns or Bruce Timm. That's just me and what I know of DC.
And The Batman's a good way to reboot the DCU, I think. Ooh,
there are ways. Yeah, no, there are definitely ways.
I think
ways
using
to do
Pattinson
it.
Is a good way to do it, though.
I think it was inevitable that film was going to get a sequel.
And I think that Aquaman can still exist the way it does because it kind of does exist in its own little cerebellum.
And if they do end up releasing Flashpoint, it seems like they're getting ready to kind of do like a multiversal thing like Marvel is doing anyway. So it wouldn't be too hard to explain like some of the characters that you've experienced in the DCEU. Granted, most of them, Ben Affleck, Henry Cavill, Ezra Miller now, Ray Fisher, a lot of people. They're not involved with that universe anymore, but mm-hmm. you still got mm-hmm. Aquaman, you still got Jason Momoa, and Gal Gadot. You can bring them into whatever universe you're
yes.
going to do,
yes.
bring over the fans from that, and then merge it with... I prefer the idea of the Batman, Matt Reeves, the Batman, kind of being its own universe in a similar way to The Dark Knight. Just because there's a ton of Batman and Batman family stories that have been out there that need to be adapted in live action.
Oh, I agree with that. However, you and I hinted at it in a previous episode when we talked about the Batman, that this is the Batman that would have plans to neutralize the entire Justice League if any and or all of them became threats.
Yes, this is the Batman that would have a plan for like, okay, Barry Allen, he's really fast. You got to find some way to make him keep running, tire himself out,
yep.
or freeze him or whatever. So I could see him absolutely doing that. It's just, I feel like a Batman works so much better. You can see it in the DCEU. Batman really wasn't very much help in most of the situations.
No, he wasn't.
He does cool things.
No, he wasn't.
But he wasn't very much help in a lot of situations.
No, and that's fine.
I can see this Pattinson being the one who's like the planner of the league. Like,
yeah.
You are good at this. You attack this.
Yes.
Hal, you're good at this. Do this.
Because Batman is the impromptu leader of the Justice League.
He is. And I do feel like they did just jump into the Justice League with the DCEU. And starting with Batman is a good, like, round up way to do it.
I mean, let's go back to the old cartoon of it. There's a scene There's a scene where almost everyone on the plane that Batman is flying can fly, but they're just on his plane, which tells you he's the leader.
It tells you they felt bad and that they know that he doesn't like being carried. So he's going to take his plane. And if they want to talk to him, well, you know,
he's the leader. He really is, because Bruce is wildly intelligent. And that's what we got in the Batman.
And I think that, yes, that didn't really get you didn't see that on display in the Justice League movies. It was just kind of like, we got to put together a team. We have to. Basically, he's just trying to make up for him fighting Superman for so long and then being like, oh, shoot, he was right. Our greatest hero is dead. I kind of am somewhat responsible for some of that.
Yeah, but
I want a Batman that's actually like forced to be with these people and has plans for, you know, if something happens, we need a way to take out Superman.
That's true.
Not going to run at it first. Maybe do like a Justice League Doom type scenario. It's just, if it takes so long to build an entire franchise,
it does. But I think that now with Discovery buying out Warner Brothers, I think that they have the idea of like, we need to put the work in. Well, guys, I mean, we had a lot this week. There was a lot of good stuff that came out. Moving forward, we got the season finale of Moon Knight. And I'm probably going to record that next week with my brother. Probably going to do a little interview with my younger brother, Bryce, and we'll talk about some of that. Corey's not going to be here, so I'm going to fill in with him. And then we got Multiverse of Madness releasing right after that.
I believe I'm going to see that Friday.
I think I'm
going
to go see that Thursday with my brother after we're done recording.
Friday or Thursday? I think it's Friday.
So, but
yeah, so that'll be on the next episode that we're both on.
Yeah. And we'll have a lot to cover again at that point. Well, guys, thanks for listening again this week. And as always, my name's Tanner.
And I'm Corey.
And this has been Dorkside Nexus.
Stay hydrated, and we'll see you in the Nexus.